So welcome back, everybody. It feels a little bit sudden that it's coming to the last afternoon. I'm curious as to how many of you are actually joining us on the weekend in person, because we made it so that there is a gap and you can fly across. So Carolina, I don't know if anyone else is joining in person on the
weekend.
I'm
joining in person.
Are you? Are you sure? I'm glad Gunter is, because he's giving us a lift. Oh, a few of you got your hands up. Wow, this is very cool. Look. All these hands coming up.
Oh, yeah.
Yay. Oh, my gosh. More and more hands showing. You're all joining us in person. Wow. That's cool. That's really cool.
So you don't have to ask the questions.
That's true. We just ignore their questions now.
I don't even
know. We wouldn't do that. All right. I've got a question here from yesterday. We either didn't see it or it came in later. I'm not sure. So here we go. Since some years, I've created a peaceful life away from family where there was a lot of anger and drama, and it helped my practice and inner happiness grow. However, I still struggle with the relationship with my older brother, who has bipolar disorder and intense anger outbursts. Even though we rarely meet, his anger deeply affects me and takes me a long time to recover from. The more peace I find in my life, the more distant I feel from him, and that brings also sadness. I know I can't change his emotions, but how can I strengthen myself so these rare but stormy interactions don't disturb me so much? How can I respond wisely and protect my inner balance in the face of someone else's anger? Thank you with all my heart for your teachings, kindness, wisdom, and radiating peace. So, shall I?
Yeah, I think we did mention that last time.
No, I just talked to you about it this morning, but and I remembered the beautiful sutta that I think Sariputta gave of, there's one that he gave about the rag, which is where you come across this old dirty rag in the street. And in the Buddha's day, of course, people made their robes out of these rags, and they see it on the floor there and they think it's useless. But then they realize that actually, if they put one foot on the rag and use the other foot to kind of tear the rag in two, they can reach down and pick up the other piece of the rag, which is still usable. They can wash it and they can make it fit for stitching into a robe. And so what this really means is that we try to focus on the good part of the person. We focus on the part of the person that we can encourage and cultivate and have a beautiful relationship with. And sometimes we leave aside the other part that is too difficult for us to face at that time. That's one way. I think another thing that you're talking about here is feeling distant from him. And I think it's important to recognize that this is not necessarily always going to be the case, but it could be that at this time you need that bit of distance. And it could be that as you develop on the path of Dhamma and in compassion and inner strength, that those angry outbursts will indeed affect you less and you'll find more compassion developing in you. So that's another way that I think this was the another sort of five ways of overcoming resentment, and this includes when people show you anger. The first one was loving kindness. The second one is compassion, realizing that that person is like a sick person. And in the other sutta from Sariputta, the same one as the rag, the Venerable Sariputta actually says it's as though they are sick, traveling in the desert without medicine, without an attendant or a doctor, far away from safety. And basically alone. And so when a person is this way, they're basically unwell, they're sick, and we arouse sheer compassion and tender concern. Compassion doesn't always mean you have to be around the person. Compassion includes compassion for yourself. But it does help to overcome any resentment and also sadness that you might have. There's also a method of actually taking distance from a person. In the suttas, it says ignoring. So they try metta, compassion, you can try equanimity, you can try understanding the law of karma, cause and effect, but also you can have distance. You can actually ignore a person for a time. And I think this is very important because it honors our own needs as well as the other person's, so that if you do find you're getting dragged down, you can take a break. But I think it's important to recognize that that break only needs to be temporary. And if your intention is to deepen your connection over time or find ways that you can still love that person, even if it's from a distance, then it can be wise to take some space. So there's a few thoughts about that. And of course, you can share your the merits of your practice with your brother. Bring him to mind, wish him well. Compassion doesn't just connect with his suffering, it wishes him freedom from that suffering. So you can visualize him free from suffering, free from these depressive and angry outbursts, and really share the goodness of your life with him. That will help you both. Okay, thank you, Ajahn Chando and Ajahn Brahm and all the volunteers for putting on this online retreat. This is the best retreat I've ever been on. Excellent. When on retreat, I feel much less irritated by the small things during the day. I watch the habitual reactions arising in the mind, and I'm just watching it, not in it, and I don't do anything with it. It feels very liberating. Is it possible to gain this sense of freedom from defilements without retreat conditions? I meditate once or twice daily, but it doesn't bring the same sense of freedom that this week has brought. Want me to answer?
Yeah.
All right. I think, honestly speaking, that retreat times are the times that you really deepen your practice, so you can see what it's like to have that extent of freedom. And of course, in the world, it's harder to sustain. However, the more you practice in retreats, the stronger your mindfulness will become, and the more those habitual reactions that cause suffering for you will be seen before they can take over. And bit by bit, they'll start to fade. So they will bother you less over time, but I think it's realistic not to expect the same level of mindfulness and kindness, etc., during the day. But if you do meditate daily, that's the key, really. That it's that continuity, you know, at least maintaining the depth of practice, or at least not going backwards on the path, and then continuing to carve out time for retreats. Every year, at least a couple of retreats a year, I would say, if you want to see real progress. But you'll be amazed. I mean, you might not think that things are changing very much. You might think, oh, now I'm back in the world, I'm more irritable again. But if you remember how you were 3 years ago, you'll realize you're actually getting irritable far less often. And when you do get irritable, it doesn't last as long. So the changes come gradually, but they're absolutely there. And after some time, these habits will really start to get undermined, and they won't be arising nearly so much again. So the practice changes a bit when we leave the retreat. It becomes a little bit more about sense restraint in daily life, which means noticing these reactions, catching them early, and sometimes shifting our thinking pattern or our perceptions away from things that trigger those unwholesome responses. And keep us on track. But also, of course, carving out that time for meditation is really important. And also in daily life, you have the chance to really deepen your practice of virtue, which is not just abstaining from killing life and stealing, etc., which most of us can do, but learning to use our speech in really beneficial, uplifting ways that can bring a lot of encouragement to ourselves, to other people, and can give us a lot of harmony in our lives. So there's many, many ways to practice in daily life that you don't get on retreat. So see if you can embrace your day-to-day life in the world as an opportunity to integrate and also deepen those foundational parts of the path. Shall I read another one?
Yeah.
A question from a practitioner seeking to develop jhana and metta qualities during an extended period of solitary free time in nature without internet access. What daily routine and supportive habits would you advise to best facilitate progress in these qualities while navigating the balance between being too tight and too loose in the practice?
Do moment by moment. Don't plan, don't set a routine. Just sit down and see what happens. In other words, keep it simple. If you have a routine, a schedule, and with that schedule comes judging yourself, how well you kept that schedule, how much your mindfulness was. Just see if you can just get rid of time and just be in this moment. Just one moment after another. See what happens, see what's needed. Nice and simple.
I remember when I was on this long retreat in Jhana Grove, and I asked you something around, oh, you know, should I emphasize this or that? And you just said, ask your body what and mind what they want to do.
Yeah.
And so that was my kind of way of practice, just asking. being really respectful rather than trying to push them into some kind of altered state or routine. Thank you so much for the warm, kind, compassionate wisdom light that radiates from you. It helped open up this lotus very well again. One difficulty I have in daily life is the use of media in a balanced way. After a retreat, it's very good for a while. Then I let myself get sucked in too much and it drains my energy and feels addictive. And it is addictive. That's the difficulty with this social media stuff or any media. Could you please give advice? I'm very much looking forward to meet you at the weekend retreat in Oxford.
I don't have social media. I do have email. And that's it. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Social media.
I mean, it is a lot easier to notice how we get sucked in straight after a retreat. I always notice that because I need to go onto Facebook to do various promotions and just spread the word, you know, about all our activities. And it's at first there's a real kind of don't want to touch it, and I'll just touch it very occasionally. And then after a while it becomes kind of like, oh, I'll just see what this friend's doing. I'll just read this particular article. And then I realize that although I don't notice I'm tired when I'm using it, afterwards I'm really drained. So one of the things that I've actually done here and keep trying to do is to kind of get the people in the monastery to hand in their phones in the evening. Ideally, it will happen before the evening sit, and then that's the end of phones for the day. So that is one way that could be helpful. If you have somebody to help you be accountable to that or somewhere to put it that it's not really easy to access, I think that's one of the ways, not to get on it in the first place, because once you're on there, it's quite tough. Of course, you can try things like setting an alarm or something, but I don't know. If you're rebellious, you'll just override it. Oh, never mind. I'll carry on anyway. So it's quite tough. But I think over time, when you see the kind of drain it has and you ask yourself, honestly, what kind of benefit is this bringing me? You know, you could have spent an hour reading a really good book. You could have done an online course. You could have meditated and got much deeper instead of having your awareness kind of dispersed into so many different directions. So it's a tricky one, but just exercising a lot of kindness and mindfulness around these effects, short-term and long-term, could help. Okay. I trained under the Vietnamese Rinzai Zen, and I'm very grateful for your pointings during this retreat. I thought of a Zen poem, which I think is appropriate. You are me, and I am you, not two, but one. When you see this, there is just you and me.
I see my eyes closed, don't see anything.
Okay. You probably say there's nothing.
Yeah, it's better.
Yeah. All right. Dear Venerables, I currently live in tropical climate. The house is surrounded by nature. Animals from the wilderness are our roommates. She's in Madagascar, I think. Oh, no, Mauritius.
Oh, yeah.
Mauritius, isn't it? Yeah. Lizards, spiders, etc. We live in harmony with each other and I give many of them names. Ants, however, have been a challenge because there were five of them and we leave them alone. In half an hour, there are literally hundreds. They get inside food. How would you keep the precept of not killing in this situation with gratitude?
Even if you could ask the ants and say, look, now please, there's plenty of food outside. So can you leave the food which we have, human food, for us inside? There's enough for all of us. Try talking to the ants. In Bodhinyana Monastery, when I was building a hut, I did most of the building work there. There was a big ant mound close to this wonderful building site. So I started building that little A-frame hut, and it took me much more work, but I made sure I never disturbed that ant mound. I'd always give it compassion. When I finished that hut, I moved into it, and those ants always would never come into the hut. I'd always be kind to them. And then one day, one of the Anagaukas, male Anagaukas, female Anagaukas would never do this. He drove a tractor over their ant mound, and I was just so sad. From that time on, the ants started coming into the hut. And these are beings, very intelligent beings. So if you could actually talk to them and ask them, please, don't come into our hut or our house and leave some food outside for them. So you tell them this is for you. Find out what they like. And then you can also assist them, they assist you. And it's not a crazy thing to do. It's done that so many times. Animals and humans, you can communicate together. We can just ask them, can you please, you know, I care for you, you care for me. We have a wonderful time. Even ants.
Yeah.
My favorite ants, you know my favorite ants? Retreat ants.
Retreat ants, yeah.
Retreaters.
Just being practical, having lived in Asia, you just have to put everything in like sealed plastic tubs. And then they will come in, but when they find there's no food, they'll leave. But you have to kind of just let them be there. I mean, we used to get in Burma, thousands. So you'd come inside and it'd be shocking sometimes. You'd have seen a little trail in the morning and you'd come inside and there'd be like a strip about a foot or 2 feet wide across the wall, like just a black strip of moving ants. And they'd have all their eggs and everything. And sometimes we'd look under our little mat on the floor because we didn't have a bed. And they were there as well with their eggs. And after a while, I realized I just had to sleep somewhere else because they moved through. Within a day, they'd be gone. So they will move through, but sometimes they're kind of breeding. And I think you just have to let them do what they need to do and just keep all your food in tubs. One really useful thing to know is that they don't like chocolate. So if you have chocolate, that's okay. You don't have to... You don't have to worry about that. But yeah, I think it's a good idea to put some outside. Dear Ajahns, thank you so much for your inspiring teachings. Yesterday, Ajahn Brahm mentioned he had a childhood memory in great detail during a meditation. A meditator I know once told me a similar story that during a meditation, he got sucked into a childhood memory and relived it as if it happened right there. Could you please tell me more about how the mind works so it's able to do that? Based upon what does it decide to show that particular memory?
Well, in my story, I was actually looking for an earliest memory, just testing the mind after it emerged from a good meditation. Then you just saw what it could remember. What's the earliest memory of this life? And that's, these things just happen. If your mind is ready for it, you can get access a beautiful memory. It was not traumatic. It was not so beautiful. It was just kind of interesting, being in my pram. One of the things I recall from that experience was that how I recognized my baby's pram was its smell. That was the dominant sense, how things smelt. I could see, I could hear, but that was not the sense I relied on more than anything else. I knew my pram, I knew my mother, I knew all the toys by how they smelt. It was kind of weird. But I also had the freedom to explore, which was also, I never thought that was possible, but it was. And it was just I was experimenting. There's no how memory works and how you can have memory of a much clearer sort based on deep meditation experiences. And these memories were just, again, a reliving, re-experiencing what had happened. So that's what happened. But I actually sought for that. I asked for it.
Thank you both for the joy you shared and wisdom. Dear Ajahn, I like endings. You like endings.
Yeah.
I dislike endings. How to change this perception?
Well, if you dislike endings, you know, that means you're always doing things. I like endings because once something ends, then there's some peace afterwards. And one of the things I always I like the endings. When I was young, for example, and we'd go to concerts, the ending of the concert, the finale, you know, the last movement of the concerto, that was by far the most inspiring. Everything would be building up to those last few minutes. And then when it came, it was just really inspiring. And I liked endings. Okay, it meant that the concert had finished, but nevertheless, everything does finish. I could always accept that. And that opened the door for new things happening. So I never thought things were ending totally, finally. They were just the first movement had finished, and now another movement would come afterwards. Just like somebody dying, when the life had died, you thought how wonderful it was that I could share many precious moments of that life with that person. And I knew there's always more things happening. But when there was an ending, it was like there was a business was finished in that area. I had to put it down and now rest. Otherwise, there's always work to be done. When there's always work to be done, it just tires you out and you cannot enjoy life with low energy. So when things do end, sadhu, 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 that day is finished. So you can rest and prepare yourself for another beautiful day.
Dear Ajahn Chanda, thank you so much for a lovely and inspiring retreat. My main takeaway is just to be in the present moment during my meditation, relax and let go instead of striving for special states. I already experience regular nimittas and piti and occasionally feel as if my body is disappearing. You've made me realize this is enough. Thank you. Yay!
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Beautiful. Thank you for a wonderful retreat. It was such a blessing to be able to participate in the retreat from home as I have difficulty traveling due to an illness. I also experienced my home, my everyday space becoming part of the monastery. Excellent. Yeah. Even outside the Zoom meetings, my home still felt like a more sacred, peaceful place. Also, despite the health challenges I face, everything's become simpler and calmer. I have greater clarity and, above all, inner peace, which I hope will stay with me for a long time.
Sadhu,
Sadhu, sadhu,
sadhu, sadhu.
sadhu. That's wonderful. I think that's one of the beautiful things about the retreats is that you learn to practice in your own space. And that's what monastics do. You know, we actually learn to practice in our own kutis. And there's very few group sittings in many forest monasteries, including Ajahn Brahm's monastery. I don't think you ever have group sittings. It's always, you come together for Vinaya once a week and for a Dhamma talk, but that's it. There's no actual group meditation. So learning that independence in the practice, even if you have the teachings from, via Zoom, is enough. And then, yeah, you grow an energy in the place that you meditate. So that's what Ajahn was talking about earlier today, about, just developing these places that have that energy of practice that you associate with meditation. And then they become like your own sacred space. So you will grow an energy in your home that way. Great. With a star shower heart, thank you, Venchanda, for sharing Majjhima 139, the Arana Vibhanga Sutta, non-conflict. It brought deep safety, clarity, and mother, father, teacher care. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. I visualize kissing your feet in adoration of the three jewels. Can you visualize
Yes, but I do remember this
that?
American monk when he saw me in Bangkok. He bent down to kiss my feet. And I said, "You're going to catch something." Because the feet over in Bangkok are not clean. There's so much dirt on the streets and stuff. But he did that anyway. But then he said, "Why?" Because he had asked me, first of all, many years ago when he was a layperson about his meditation, and I gave him some really good advice, and he eventually became a meditation teacher as a monk. And so I can understand that when you have so much gratitude, that's someone that you really help them and really help them, of course you feel like doing something like that.
But they can't do that because they're on the other side of the
Yeah.
computer. Okay. I'll read the rest to Ajahn later. We'll keep hold of these comments so that we can share these comments later on. And also, if anybody is willing to share these comments, I love this one from about the sickness. Where was that? Yeah, there's a couple of comments that are really beautiful. So, with your permission, if we could share them in a newsletter, please let us know. Okay. Thank you for building a worldwide online community. Hi from Argentina. Thank you for the teachings, advice, and care. I love putting my heart and good intentions into what I do. I sometimes get too involved and keep pushing when stopping would have been wiser. Going back to the land auction story, how can we tell whether it's time to let go if an extra push is needed? Is there a Bhikkhuni monastery and a large piece of land in Australia on its way. Well, we have that monastery already. That's where I spent 3 years before I came here. Thanks for your YouTube videos and thanks to everyone who helped make the retreat run smoothly. Hoping to meet in person someday soon. So I think the difference between pushing and kind of, what was the question? And time to let go. For me personally, if it's something noble, if it's something that I'm convinced is going to bring many, benefit to many, and it's something coming from really good intentions, then I give it everything I can. The letting go is the part which leaves the results to nature, leaves the results to Dhamma, if you like, and lets them happen in their own time. But I will keep going with it. So it is a kind of, you could call it a push, but I just consider it like a commitment, like a passion that's fueled by beautiful intentions, not by wanting, but by loving kindness, by compassion, by a kind of belief in what I'm doing as being of benefit to many. And then if it still doesn't work, that's when you let go. You know you've done your best. So if it doesn't work, never mind. You did your best. What else could you do? And that's how this place worked. That's how we made this place.
Give it more than you can.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
More than you should think possible.
Yeah, more than you ever believe possible.
You know, inspiration can actually break down barriers.
Yeah.
And limits.
Yeah. I think often people think that, you know, pushing has to come from wanting, or sort of activism has to come from anger and a sense of injustice, but it can sometimes come from other sources of energy, which are far more sustainable, like inspiration, compassion, sheer kind of gratitude. I mean, Anukampa Bhikkhuni Project and now Anukampa Grove may seem to have come around through my wish to bring women this opportunity. But honestly, the first intention was to pay my debt of gratitude to my teacher, Ajahn Brown. And it was that energy of immense gratitude, and you could call it devotion, to you as my teacher and trust in you as my teacher, that kind of fueled the energy. Because I really felt like I want to put everything I have into this as a gift. And of course, it's become much more than a gift to Ajahn Brown. It's a gift to hopefully many people, including myself, because I get the rewards of having not given up and now seeing wonderful young women having the chance to develop in monastic life without the worry of getting completely sick in an Asian country where the climate and the food don't suit them, without the fear that their visas are going to expire, all the things that maybe we don't realize are kind of difficult aspects of monastic life. So it's very heartwarming. So I think if it's something that's a noble cause, just give it everything. And as Ajahn Brahm says, more than you even imagine can be possible. What is the difference between the link between consciousness and Nama Rupa, independent imagination, and the simile of the two bamboo sheaves, the two sheaves of reeds, leaning on each other? Could you explain the meaning of these two concepts?
Okay. Consciousness, especially the mind consciousness, needs its object to exist. It's not just like a TV screen or a screen on your computer. You need some information to be displayed on that screen in order for it to exist. And that's just the same with consciousness, the objects of consciousness. Without one, the other doesn't exist. What that tells us is that the consciousness, the screen, it's not always there. Sometimes the screen vanishes, just doesn't exist anymore, without the objects to be displayed on it. Without one, the other cannot persist.
Yep. Okay. When entering my... Oh, have we had one from her already? Okay, I'm just going to try and make sure we answer different people's questions. What I'm starting to recognize is that until now I couldn't deal with the anger of others because I couldn't deal with my own anger. Now, in a very deep and painful phase of being honestly welcoming to my anger and kind of despair, my teacher said desperation is something we work with in deep vipassana. Is it necessary to go through very painful states on the way to nibbana? Whether it's necessary or not, it's not as though we need to kind of decide to face difficult things. But if they arise naturally in your practice and they need to be seen and responded to with kindness, then they will keep coming up. So you will have much of a choice about that. It's not that it's necessary. Some people might never feel despair. They might feel other things, but we basically don't get to choose. You know, if there's something that hasn't been seen yet and it needs to be seen for your own spiritual growth, then try to welcome it and embrace it. And that seems like what you've been doing. And I completely agree that, you know, we often can't hold space for other people's, say, sadness if we haven't made space for our own. When we've become intimate with our own sadness and we're no longer afraid of that, but we can hold space, we can stay present, we can be kind to it, then we can give that presence, safety, and space to other people's sadness too. And that's incredibly healing. So in a sense, when we do face difficult emotions, they can be a gift enabling you to meet other people where they are too. So it's not really a question of whether you need to or you don't need to, or when or how it arises, whether in what kind of practice it arises. But if it's coming, then it's there for you. It's teaching you something if you can let it in. So I think you're doing just fine. While I'm enjoying the retreat, I also had to deal with the news that my daughter's failed her first uni exam due to depression caused by a breakup. She's also going through a gender transition while also managing ADHD and potential autism. Oh, I feel for your daughter. I really feel for her. Wow, that's a lot. Your teachings have helped me a lot to embrace the situation with kindfulness. Eventually, some insights emerged. Trust and patience is the best gift we can give to our adolescent kids, as well as our wobbly self entangled in the hindrances. Oh, I like the last part there, as well as our wobbly self. I'm guessing that that means you're just trying to show up as you are for your daughter. And I think that's really beautiful. If an adult can say, you know, I'm just learning too. I don't always know how to handle it, but I'm here for you anyway. And let's do this together. You know, sometimes I struggle, but we'll work it out together. You know, I'm not perfect. I don't have all the answers. That's actually deeply inspiring for the child. It's like you're humble enough to be open enough to learn. And I'm sure she'll have so much to teach you. I actually wouldn't worry too much about the exams at this stage. It's actually not her main focus. If she's going through a gender transition, whilst also managing these different neurodiversities that she may be having, then that is about learning to orient herself in the world, first of all, finding out who she is and how to work with her own mind, her own body, so that she's comfortable and at ease. And so university can come later. I didn't go till I was 27. And that was only because I didn't find a monastery till then. And I studied Indian studies, like Indian medicine, as if I would have done that at 18 years old. I wouldn't have known it existed. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. It might be just that there are other things that are more important right now. And what she really needs support with is that depression. So if you can be there and show her your unconditional love, that is absolutely fantastic. And I really hope that her difficulties pass soon and that she comes to a very wholesome understanding of who she is and what she wants. Okay, I've heard some people say that if one can meditate deeply, it's possible to keep sleep to as little as 3 hours and still feel energetic during the day. Do you agree with this? Everybody's different. Also, some say meditation can be as short as just a few minutes. Would you still consider that meditation, or would it be more accurate to call it mindful or deep breathing?
I wouldn't call that meditation only 3 minutes. Because if it do get peaceful, why not stay for a little bit longer and allow the effects of meditation to go more deeply into you? And when it comes to that first question, you can keep your meditation down to 3 hours. But sometimes you don't keep it down. Just you don't feel like sleeping if you've had many, many deep experiences of meditation. Sometimes you don't want to sleep at all. You lay down. When you lay down, you can relax the body, but you don't fall asleep even for a minute. Then you get up again and do some more meditation or whatever else is occupying you in that period of time. You don't need to sleep. So that's the answer. Okay, go on.
Yeah, I'm just checking how many more questions. Probably three more. We do our best here. The retreat hasn't brought me the peace I was hoping for, but it's brought me the truth I was needing. Yay, that's fantastic. In this safe space, I've been able to look at some difficult circumstances in my life. And for the first time, I've been seeing them with a perspective of self-love and self-care. Now I'm in a lot of pain, but I have clarity. I feel like my self-esteem and dignity are back. So thank you for that. That's fantastic.
Well done.
Okay, there was one here. When entering my daily world after retreat, how can I practice mindful restraint from the activities and habits that appeal to the dopamine-craving caveman brain?
I'm a caveman. I live in a cave. And I've got a caveman brain. I love my cave. I love the solitude of it, the quietness there. But that quietness, I know how to make use of that. And it makes me really peaceful when you come out of your cave. You have this knot of sensitivity to not just human beings, but all the animals around you. And you try your very best to spread that kindness and that peace. So anyhow, after the retreat is finished, just remember the retreat is never really finished. And that's one of the reasons why. Please grant yourself the time to do some meditation, at least half an hour. If you meditate during lunchtime or meditate in the mid-afternoon or wherever, you're a much nicer person to live with. And you can relax much more and you find you don't need so much sleep. This is how we make time in the world. And we don't use it to fantasize or dream or get angry. We can actually use it peacefully. And so our whole body and mind are under less stress during the daytime, which means we don't react and vent our frustrations or our pain to others, unless there's something beneficial there. We can be more peaceful and a better friend, a more loving companion.
Okay, this may be the last question. Let's see. Thank you again for this wonderful retreat. We practiced it a few times during the retreat, but I didn't feel anything. Practiced what? Perhaps I'm so drained from almost 2 years sickness, or perhaps I feel so peaceful during the retreat I don't feel much emotion. I don't know. So how do I practice it if I don't feel it? Practice what? Ajahn Chanda mentioned several times that metta practice is very helpful, so I'm curious about how it works. I'm not quite sure what you're not feeling here. You did say you felt peaceful, so I'm wondering if you mean the emotions of metta or happiness or PT or something like this. So, yeah, it could well be that if you've been sick for 2 years, it's harder to get those emotional kind of happinesses arising in the mind and the metta. But metta practice is not just the feeling of love, a really good, pleasant, beautiful warmth that you feel in the mind. It's also an attitude that you have towards feeling not much at all, an attitude that you have towards the sickness, just a kindness, just a letting it be, allowing it to be that way. And if you are peaceful but not very emotional, well, peace is actually an emotion. You know, at first it doesn't feel like very much. But after a while, when you start to tune into it, you realize there's something beautiful there. And I think this is also when we can reflect on what's missing. You know, there's a lovely sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. I think it's the Chula Sunyata Sutta, probably, the shorter discourse on emptiness. And it's talking about noticing the absence of disturbances. So this is where I think it starts off with a person who was living in the city, and then they go to the forest and they notice the absence of a city, the absence of noise, the absence of the commotion of being in a very busy, noisy, smelly place. And then when they move from the forest or they go deeper inside, they just notice only earth, the absence of forest and something much simpler. And it keeps on going through the sutta like this. I can't exactly remember the details. What else is absent there? Do they talk about absence of thought and absence of the body?
Yes.
Yeah. So in other words, it gets increasingly refined, but rather than noticing, oh, there's only body here or whatever, you notice what there's an absence of. And there's a beauty in that. There's a peace in that. And that becomes something. It doesn't just become a void. So when things are empty of, say, agitation or restlessness, then you feel peace. So notice that, and then that peace will actually start to shimmer and grow. So don't worry about it. You can't force emotions. You can't kind of force anything. But I do think a metta practice every single day is incredibly helpful, not only just at the end of your meditation, but actually maybe when you wake up in the morning, you can have thoughts of loving kindness to your poor, sick body, to your lack of energy or whatever it is. And also at the end of the day, when you go to bed, you can just spread thoughts of loving kindness to the whole world. And I love to spread metta at the end of a meditation so that I recognize I'm not doing this just for myself. It doesn't really matter whether it's been peaceful, whether I felt a lot of joy or not, or whether there's a lot of insight arising, whatever it is, I just offer it on. And then that helps with a sense of not owning our practice and practicing for the benefit of all. Okay, we might actually get to the last question here. We've got 3 minutes. Thank you so much for this wonderful opportunity. It's been wonderful and enriching. I look forward to building on it in the weeks and months to come. I know you've been explaining the principle through the whole week, but my mind is still circling it without landing. So how do I stop trying to do the letting go and instead let go of doing? Should I just stop trying to get it and wait for my mind to get there on its own? Much gratitude for all your wisdom.
I would suggest that beautiful way of expressing loving kindness, because loving kindness is no different than letting go. And that beautiful way is, you know, to be able to open the door of your heart. And what is happening, whether you succeed in letting go, you don't succeed in letting go, that's not the point. You open the door of your heart and let this moment be. And you find that is letting go.
Beautiful. And it's the I, isn't it, that gets in the way? It's when I try, that I is involved. So when we learn to just see whatever's arising as nature, that's another way of helping the letting go.
Remember that little cartoon we have in the kitchen at Jhana Grove? It's this guy going up to this holy man and a holy woman. And it says, a little poster, I want happiness. And he's very angry. And then the monk or the nun says, give me that poster. First mistake, the I. So he crosses that out. So the poster now is want happiness. Second mistake, want. And he crosses that out. What does that leave? Happiness. And that's the last frame of the cartoon with both people very, very happy.
It's great. Yeah,
simple but profound.
Absolutely. Wow, thank you so much for your questions. There was one message for Ajahn about a dream. I'm going to pass that on to him afterwards because it is a bit beyond the scope of the time. So thank you so much.